Hey everyone, this is Jeannie. I use she, her pronouns, and you're listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour, a podcast hosted by the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault. It's the end of June, the month that hosts Father's Day, and it feels appropriate to talk about the role of men and fathers in the fight against gender-based violence. Side note, a very, very belated Father's Day to all the dads, father-in-laws, soon-to-be dads, cat dads, dog dads, and so on. I do want to take a moment to notice and mention that I'm also thinking about those of you who might have difficult relationships with your fathers, to those who have lost their fathers, and to those fathers who have lost their children. We see you, and we hope you're surrounded by loved ones no matter who they are. Okay, so lately we've been seeing more men take up the fight against gender-based violence. Many men are doing work around understanding masculinity and delineating what is healthy versus what is toxic. Celebrities like Terry Crews and Justin Baldoni are actively trying to dismantle and unpack the ways that they've been taught to think and behave. There has been an uptick in the number of articles and think pieces where men examine their behaviors and beliefs, past and present, about sex and sexuality and consent. Personally, it's been really encouraging to witness. There's still a bit of work to be done, of course, but we thought it would be interesting to see how men are addressing this topic in their everyday lives. More specifically, we want to hear about dads. So we asked a few fathers about their experiences in understanding and fighting sexual violence and harassment. As always, we encourage all listeners to do whatever you need to do to take care of yourselves as you listen today. This topic can be difficult, and there is one father who discloses an incident that happened to someone close to him. All right. Let's get to our dads and hear what they have to say about fatherhood and their roles as dads in preventing violence. Hi there. Thank you so much for being with us today. Please tell us who you are, what you do for a living, and to the extent that you're comfortable doing so, a little bit about your family.
Okay, my name is Randy Harris. I work for the New York City Alliance. I'm the finance coordinator. Family, married, have a wife who's in the field. I have two kids. An 8-year-old and a 4-year-old.
My name is Jonathan, and I live in Maryland. I'm trained as a network engineer. I work as a systems administrator for a financial services firm, and I've been married for 5 years, and I have a daughter who is 1.5 years old.
So my name is Alex Reed. I'm a nonprofit tax attorney, and I am the father of 2 children. Oliver is 3, and Isadora is 6 months.
Great. Thanks so much for chatting with me today. So, as you know, I work at the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault. In light of that, and in this new era of hashtag MeToo, I'm curious what you think the role of a father, or men in general, is in preventing sexual and domestic violence.
Sure. So, this was tougher to answer than I expected it to be. I think that at the base, the father's duty in this regards is to set the right example. That's something that we have a lot of control over and something that we should actively be doing anyway. If the Me Too movement is a reminder, then all the better for it.
I mean, I think they play a huge role. Men do kind of have to check ourselves in the sense that, you know, if we're at the front or if we're the problem with domestic violence, then it's a thing where you need to look in the mirror. It's like having accountability, you know. So I don't know how that plays as far as the climate we're in, or as far as, you know, society, how it's shaped men to be or not caring or really caring, but we do hold a great responsibility, because if we're inflicting damage or anything like that to someone, then you should, I don't know, feel accountable for it, or you should be the one to change that, or whatever you can control, you should do something about it.
I think that men in general, in addition, need to feel comfortable with their voice and speaking up as part of the movement, as opposed to feeling as though it's directed at them. And I feel like I'm seeing a lot of that.
I guess with the whole Me Too movement climate, I do notice that it's been a little weird between men and women. I mean, it's the kind of thing where I feel we all could be on the same side. I mean, I feel that men definitely need to have respect for women and not impose whatever pre-stuff that society has said that we, you know, dominance or whatever, you know. But I do think that, you know, there's a little separation where it's like, oh, Me Too for women, and then guys have the issue. And it's like a clash. And I mean, when it shouldn't be a clash, it should be like someone has a problem, then you address it, and then you see how you can address it together. It's not like, you know, my problem and that's your problem over there. I feel like we're all part of it. So.
Oh, yeah. So there's a huge role. I think it's we are equal partners, if not share a greater responsibility to do what we can to really change the culture around sexual assault and awareness. As a father, I think it's important to try to impart new ways of thinking about gender and equality and teaching that both to boys and girls. And it's important to push back against gender stereotypes that really start when the baby's in the womb. It's quite incredible. I'm sure you've read about all of that, but it's incredible to actually witness it and to see efforts by well-meaning others, friends and family and society in general, to cause your fetus to conform to gender stereotypes, like, you know, oh, it's going to be a big boy, and oh, she's going to be a beautiful girl. I think that those stereotypes themselves are the beginning of creating these inflexible gender boundaries that really contribute to making it harder to push back against efforts to dehumanize people so that they can be assaulted or treated without respect. You have to start with unpacking stereotypes if you're going to give full meaning to the range of human experience that we all have.
From a father's standpoint, it's teaching your kids. I mean, it's me being from a different era, and then now in this era and raising kids in this era, it's hard to maybe merge the 2 hours, because I don't know how your take on it, but it's a little different old school kind of way as far as new school. So it's like you're relearning what's correct and what's incorrect. So now you have to go through that process of learning that, and then now you have to pass it on to your kids and let them know what's acceptable and not acceptable.
Ooh, I'm really glad that you mentioned this, because I think something we tend to forget is that while we're trying to socialize and teach our kids, we're simultaneously relearning and re-socializing ourselves, and that's really important to acknowledge, and it's also really challenging, at least I would imagine. This is actually kind of a perfect segue into my next question, which is, did you ever have conversations like this with your parents, whether it was the sex talk or the birds and the bees or something that you got before you went off to college? And if so, what do you remember?
A little bit. I remember, I was a teenager in the 80s, or young teenager, and I liked to play the game Dungeons & Dragons, so nerd alert. and there was one of the players in our group, so I was about 13, one of the players was, I guess he was 19 or something, and he was gay, and my mom asked me, as she was driving me to the Dungeons and Dragons meetup, she said, if you're gay, I just want you to know that it's okay. And I said, thanks, Mom. I didn't really even know what she was talking about, but she was, they were very supportive about sexual preference, nonconformity, and open to that. So I thought that was good.
Me? No, I didn't have that conversation. I'm from a West Indian background, from Barbados, and it's more of a old school kind of show respect to your mother, father. Don't talk out of turn, no back talk, respect kind of thing. So they were very, rigid on certain topics, and they wouldn't really go into that. So me learning anything in that area came from friends or experiences with people in my age group or cousins or stuff like that. But as far as my parents sitting down having a conversation or the sex talk per se, no, I didn't have that.
This was an easy one for me. I definitely did not have that conversation with my parents. I distinctly remember that the first time I had any sort of quote real sex talk was when I was 18. I remember it vividly. I was sitting in the den of my girlfriend's home at the time, and my oldest brother called me to check in, just as we randomly did at the time. And the conversation ended with, oh yeah, and if you're thinking about having sex, just use protection. You cannot afford to have a kid right now. And he wasn't wrong, but at 18, I already knew that. But that really was the extent of, being my oldest brother in an Indian family, maybe that was an okay route to take, because the oldest brother can be seen as sort of a father figure. So I don't know if he had talked to my parents and that was their way of getting the message across to me, but it wasn't the ideal way and it wasn't much of a message.
Do you think your cultural or ethnic background had anything to do with why you didn't receive that talk?
That is exactly it. My parents are immigrants. They've been here for almost 40 years now, but they're really culturally conservative, South Indian, and they're devout Roman Catholics. So that kind of puts a point on it.
I see. Is there anything you wish you'd known or been told about these topics?
Sure. I mean, I wish, like, I grew up in also a single household. It was just my mother, and it was me, my sister, and my mother. So I wish I had insights as far as how to deal with women, not just from a observing standpoint, but, you know, my mother may be saying, this is what you do and this is what you do, and maybe from my father, this is how you be as a man, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, definitely wish I had those kind of teachings and whatnot to fall back on.
You know, in terms of teaching me about gender relations, they were pretty quiet about it, I would say. You know, they were always happy to answer any questions I had, but most of the sex talk that we had was, you know, make sure to wear a condom and that sort of thing. It wasn't so much about make sure you get consent. I think it went without saying. I mean, it shouldn't have, but I think it mostly did, because treating people with respect was such an important value.
I didn't have a lot of open conversations with my parents about relationships in general, not just intimate sexual relationships, but just emotions and the way that, you know, you interact with people and the way that people change your lives. It's just something that wasn't ever touched on. And I think that would have been useful. On the flip side, my father always made sure, you know, and my mother, but I distinctly remember my father being the one to always make sure that we treated people well. Didn't matter who they were or what they looked like, but that was always the message. So I think that in that way, I was always guided correctly.
Do you remember hearing about consent or sex from other sources, since the one that you got from home was limited?
I don't remember any particular point, but I had a good number of friends in school and, you know, in high school and college where we would talk about these sorts of topics. And it's funny to think about now, because more often than not, it was all done in jest. But through that and getting, you know, the female perspective there, I think that really shaped the way I felt.
Well, you know, I had exposure in another way, which perhaps informed my understanding of the topic more than anything else, which is that I have an older brother who has Down syndrome. And throughout his life, he has at various times been victimized by sexual assault. It's very common in the disability community that there's sexual predation by people within and without the community. And so there have been all sorts of issues that, you know, that we've dealt with as a family over the years, you know, including there was a much beloved babysitter who turns out was assaulting the kids with disabilities. I think my brother was spared that, but many of his friends had been victimized. And then his fiance experienced a number of assaults over her life. He himself, when he lived in a group house, there was another person who lived in the group house who would go into his room when he didn't want him to, and the question was, could we get a lock on the door, etc. So there was a lot of consent and sexual violence and predation questions that I was exposed to as a young child through my brother, and I'd say that was the main lens that I saw it, rather than through male-female sexual violence.
Wow, thank you for sharing that with me. And I'm so sorry that you and your family and your brother and his fiance had to go through all of this. That's a really painful and unfortunate way to learn about sex and consent. And you're right, people in the differently abled communities suffer a significantly higher rate of sexual assault. The percentages are just unbelievably high.
It's almost universal, I would say. Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not a one-off. I would say every couple of years there's something new that happens to him.
So that leads really well into my next question, which is whether or not you and your partner will be talking to your kids about sex and consent and violence, and if so, when, how, what are the important messages that you want to relay to them, and if not, why not?
I think it's unavoidable, being the fact that, like I said, my partner is in this field, so she deals with that every day, so definitely is going to be talked about in the house. So me, as far as knowing how to do it, I may have to take cues from her, V, you know, to see how to teach the kids or how to go about doing it. But definitely we will be having those talks because, like I said, I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. And even with my 8-year-old, I see things already happening in school, situations with school where, like, interaction with girls, you know, from if it goes from, oh, girls are icky or, you know, we only hang out with the boys, we don't hang out with the girls, and then when we interact with the girls, how do you interact with girls in an appropriate manner? So all of those things come up at this young of age. So
yeah, we have absolutely thought about that. I think the when will really depend on her development, of course, when we think she might be ready to have that conversation, but definitely before we think it's necessary. I think the points that we'll get across or try to get across is that, you know, assertiveness is not a bad thing, but that at the offset that she has a real right to be selfish. She has to know herself, her body, what feels good, because that's the only way she'll be able to confidently get that over to her partner. And I think that as long as she's able to focus on what she needs first, she'll be able to properly assess what her partner's needs are, you know, in the future and how she needs to react to that.
Yeah, I absolutely will address all of this openly with them. There's a book that's sort of, I guess, open source, you'd say, that you can download that talks about trying to teach kids about consent and awareness of their own bodies and areas that are private to them and that they should feel empowered to refuse to allow others to touch. So we've worked on that with them. There's a lot of consent and violence and touching that's permitted and not permitted, you know, not having anything to do with sex, but with, you know, stop tickling me, you know, don't poke me in the eye, please. It's, you know, that mommy's nursing Isadora, so, you know, you can't touch her breast right now, things like that. And just teaching about what you can, you know, we use the phrase my body a lot in our house where we want them to feel that they have the right to say what happens with their bodies. And we also try to enforce our own boundaries and right to consent to being touched or hit or whatever. And so, you know, even at a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old level, there's a lot involving bodies and consent.
I like that you mentioned that because I think teaching kids about consent doesn't have to be explicitly about sex or inappropriate touching. And I think there's kind of a misconstrued understanding around that. But it can start with something more basic, like you don't have to hug so-and-so if you don't want to, you know?
You know, the whole boys will be boys thing that is so toxic in the later in the consent and violence with women starts much, much, much earlier than that, you know, about rough play and rough housing and teasing and bullying. It's, I think, important to be consistent throughout. It's not like you can bully your other boys and other people in your class when you're a little kid and then suddenly start treating people with respect when you hit puberty. It's got to start a lot earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you saying all of that.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, it's actually quite challenging as a parent to really model it perfectly because being a parent is you're very power up and what you say goes and you get angry, you know, when your kid does something that you don't want them to do or when they're doing something dangerous or even when they're being abusive towards another kid, it makes you mad. But in those moments, that's exactly when you're feeling emotional, that's exactly when you need to be thoughtful about what you're doing, you know, and you can't, you still have to run it through your mental process to make sure that you don't just act violently or pick up a kid and violently remove them from the situation instead of explaining what's going on. And it's very hard to actually walk the talk from the power-up position of being a parent. So it's an interesting exercise.
I think this is all such great information, and I actually really like what you said because I think it really drives home that this is not easy. Parenting is not easy, and teaching kids while you're also re-socializing yourself and trying to do your best is, it's just not an easy task for anyone. So I think a lot of people will appreciate hearing that perspective, that it's really not an easy thing to do. Well, we are really grateful for all of your experiences and thoughts, and I want to end on a high note, so I wanted to ask if you'd be willing to share a funny dad story or anecdote that you have.
Kids are crazy. My kids are crazy. They do a lot of things. They make you question, why did you have kids?
Right now, we're, you know, at right around age 3, so it's a, we call it being a three-nager. You commonly hear about the terrible twos, but it's really the three, right around 3, at least in our case, that they seem to get a surge of hormones, and suddenly they get very interested in gender. So I'm no scientist here, but my speculation is that the two things are connected, and they really start behaving like teenagers in puberty. And so he's become interested in gender now in a way that he wasn't before. And so he likes to talk about, you know, the differences between boys and girls. And so he's learning what chromosomes are, because we figure that's, if there's anything we can say that's fundamental about sex and gender, we can say that there are different chromosomes. So he will now say, you know, that's mama's because she has 2X chromosomes. and that's for daddy because he has a Y chromosome. And we say, well, that's sort of right, but it's closer than most 3-year-olds. So I don't know. We'll, I'm sure, you know, they say you always burn the first one. I'm sure we will have made many, many mistakes that he will require therapy in the future, and we'll kick ourselves about it. But, you know, we're doing our best.
Yes, I have a story, and it does kind of tie, not kind of, it very much ties back into everything we're talking about. We've all heard about the terrible twos with babies, and Matilda, my baby, is reaching that age. And part of it is learning to say no, which she's just starting to do, and it's really adorable for the most part. You know, do you want applesauce? No, but she really wants applesauce. And we can go through a whole series of conversations now where she will talk about, or not talk about, but she'll be really clear about things that she wants. And I'll keep asking her, hey, do you want X, Y, Z? No, no, no. And at the very end of it, I'll ask, do you know what you're talking about? And she will drop her voice to a whisper and say, no. And I find it to be the most adorable thing in the world, but really gets across the fact that, yeah, these kids, they don't know, and they don't know for a long time, and they need a lot of direction, and, you know, I think we're on our way.
We certainly are on our way. Well, thank you to all of our great dads, Alex, Randy, and Jonathan. I learned a lot from them today, and I hope some of you listeners did as well. Okay, so it's time for our new segment. We are starting a new segment from here on out called Let's Talk Sex, and this is the first time we've ever done it, so it might change kind of over the years, but we'll see how it goes. So I'm going to be asking a question about sex to a random person and just kind of see what they have to say. So our first ever segment features Alex. Hi, please introduce yourself.
Hi, yes, my name is Alex.
Okay. All right, Alex, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is an orgasm to you?
Well, it's definitely pretty up high up there. Is, you know, that seems like the ultimate goal. That's what you're trying to reach. So on the higher end of the scale, but I think being a little bit older now, you know, you realize that it's more of the full package that goes along with the orgasm. So it's not, you know, just reaching the goal, but also the journey that you take in there. So maybe a seven. We'll go with 7 because it is definitely, you don't want to go without that.
That's it. Our new segment is short and sweet. Thank you, Alex, for being the first person featured on Let's Talk Sex. We hope you had fun answering the question. Listeners, let us know what you think about our new segment on social media, and remember to use our hashtag SexTalkHappyHour, all one word. Thank you to the Alliance staff, and specifically my supervisors, for giving me the green light and supporting me on this project. To Nikki Cruz, our social media guru, and of course, to our featured fathers today, Alex, Randy, and Jonathan, a belated Happy Father's Day to all of you. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Google Play, and tell your friends to do the same. We hope to bring you more conversations like this, and we always want to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have feedback or thoughts, or you have a topic you'd like to hear us talk about, you can tweet at us at NYCAASA or message us on Instagram at NYC Alliance. And one more time, make sure you use our hashtag Sex Talk Happy Hour, all one word. Thanks so much for listening in. Ciao for now. We'll see you next time.